Please grab your Bibles and turn to Luke chapter 15. As Sarah mentioned, I am finishing the story today, slightly different than last week. Let me set the scene for you, because the scene is crucial. The scene is absolutely crucial to understanding why Jesus tells the story and why he tells the story the way that he does. So Jesus is with his disciples, and the crowds are gathering around him, and it's a pretty mixed crowd. There are a lot of people around Jesus who don't normally attend church or any religious function, and among them are the drug addicts, the people who leave the needles on the playgrounds. That's the people hanging out with Jesus. And their dealers are there too. And among them are the prostitutes, some of those women who wave to your husbands as you're driving by. Yeah. It's the love boutique owners. And that has nothing to do with love. It's the gang members hanging out in that crowd too. Some of the people who tried to break in my shed the other week. It's the identity thieves, and I know that that happened to at least one person here. The people who are, you know, out to make a quick buck, and they don't really care who they hurt. It's the homeless. They're there with their bag of cans and their shopping carts. It's the scam artists, the guys who almost got my Visa number, because I'm a little naive sometimes. This is the crowd. This is the crowd around Jesus right now. The addicts are itching their track marks. And the dealers have their stash in their pockets. And the gang members have their neck tattoos and they're packing heat. This is the crowd that's hanging out around Jesus. And there are a number of people there that probably have some rainbows on their clothes. And then Unity Baptist is there too, the evangelicals with their smiling pastor. And the Bible trivia winners are there. You know, the people who know their Bibles inside and out. And, you know, the Lift Up Red Deer Prayer Warriors are there. The YC speakers are there. And the Break Forth worship teams are there. They're all mixed in together. And that crowd, the Unity Baptist crowd, is grumbling about how Jesus is on his second pint, trading laughs with the first crowd. They're down at the Troubled Monk. Why wouldn't they be? Well, Unity Baptist isn't too happy about it, as you can tell from the nervous laughter. If you don't imagine that type of scene, then you don't understand the crowd that was there that day when the scripture says that the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling that Jesus was welcoming the tax collectors and the sinners. That was the dynamic. So with that in mind, let's hear the scriptures, because it's in response to that that Jesus tells this parable. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate. I want my inheritance now." So he, the father, divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had and he set off for a distant country. And there he squandered his wealth in wasteful living. After he had spent everything there, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed his pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he finally came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out And I will go back to my father, and I'll say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up, and he went back to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him, and he ran and threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he's found.' And they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was out in the field. And when he came near the house, he heard the music and the dancing. So he called one of the servants, and he asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come home,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I have been slaving for you, and I've never disobeyed one of your commandments. Yet you never even gave me so much as a young goat so that I could party with my friends. And when this son of yours, who squandered your property with prostitutes, when he comes home, you kill the fatted calf?' 'My son, my son,' the father replied, 'you're always with me, and everything that I have is yours, but we had to celebrate because this brother of yours was dead, and he's alive again. He was lost, and he's found.' This is the word of the Lord." Last week, we talked about prodigal son. It's a group of people who walk away from God in all of the obvious ways, all of the overt ways. And some do it for longer than others, right? We all have our own prodigal son moments where we give God the finger and we walk away. And sometimes we come back really quickly and other times it takes longer. But the world just isn't easily divided into prodigals and older brothers. We, I think, all have to admit that there is a bit of the prodigal son in us. But there is that group of people that they're gone for longer. I'm not going to repeat last week's message all about the compassion that the Father has for those who are currently walking away from him. You can go listen to that online. This week we're talking about the older son, this older brother. It's the people who pull away from God in all of the subtle ways that maybe no one else in the room would notice, but we do it. We can be passive-aggressive with God, actually. Passive-aggressive people just drive me insane. Do they drive you nuts, too? Like, we can be passive-aggressive with God, and it comes out in this passage. But there are people who just, they pull away in subtle ways. And the pulling away, because it's passive-aggressive, it's at the same time, it's an attack on God. And that's what's happening here. These are the people whose hearts have wandered from the Father's heart. They aren't close with God anymore. It's sort of like that marriage that looks fine to outsiders, but inside, although they've been faithful to one another in the sense of they haven't cheated, they aren't close. And that's what is happening here with this older son. His heart is not close with the Father. He's been pulling away. And you know what? I pull away. We all pull away. So I'm going to preach to myself because I'm looking at a room full of older brothers and a room full of prodigals, and I see both in the mirror myself. So let's have some humility as we listen to this text. You know, I as I mentioned last week, I picked this story because in a sense we all approach Easter as one of these two brothers, or as both of them, at different times. Sometimes we walk out the front door and we act like we wish God were dead. And then we tell ourselves that I'm going to do it my way. My way is better, and I'm going to be my own boss or my own parents, and I don't need either because we're going to do what we want. And then other times, we walk out the back door like the older son. We're still doing our chores, still getting things done, and everything looks fine on the outside. But it's not fine. We're pulling back, and we keep God at arm's length, and we don't quite make eye contact with God. Does this resonate? We become passive-aggressive. If you don't do what I want you to do, I'm going to make you pay. Both these sons need their father, and both of them are lost in different ways. So let's work through this story here. Remember what kicks off the story. What kicks off the story is the younger son telling his father that he would rather have his money than him. He wishes he were dead. And so because he's not dead, he wants what's coming to him now. I wish you were dead. Give me your money. I'm out of here. And that's what he does. And amazingly, the father says, okay. And he divides up his property. The older son gets more. That doesn't come out in this passage because everyone in their culture knows the older son gets more. So maybe the younger son gets a third or something like that. He gets a lot of money, but he doesn't get as much as the older son. The older son and the father are now partners because it says he divided his property between them. So it's in some sense still the father's, and in another sense it's all the older brother's. But they are now partners in what remains. The older brother then goes back out to the fields to work. He's a farmer. He's going to keep doing his duty. And now this poor guy has more to do because they have fewer hands to help do it, right? And maybe it's getting close to harvest, or maybe it's seed time. Like maybe it's one of those times where it's like, you left us holding the bag at the worst possible time. I can't believe you would do that. And I wonder, you know, farming is work where there's a lot of time to reflect. And I have a feeling, and in fact, I think I could point it out in the text, it really does seem like this older brother is stewing in his juices because it comes out a couple of times, like he just explodes. So I've sort of been thinking, mulling over, what is it that he's telling himself while he's working out in the fields? And I think it's things like, I can't believe he ditched us. I can't believe he left us holding the bag. I can't believe he embarrassed us publicly like that. We have so much shame on our family now. Like, we can't even look at our neighbors in the eyes anymore because of what he's done. And what was my father thinking? Like, this kid deserved a beating from my dad. I bet that's what he's thinking. Now, word of caution. Let's beware of our own self-talk. I've seen it sometimes in my kids where they'll be like, I'm so stupid. I'm like, no, you're not. But you see the self-talk coming out. Or you hear someone say, I'm not worth anything. What's been going on internally? What are the things that we tell ourselves? Sometimes we get ourselves really worked up about things, and I think that's what's going on with this older brother. The self-talk has been going on for a long time, and it's not healthy. So let's beware of our unhealthy self-talk. I need to learn that more than anyone. Well, older brother's out in the fields, and when the workday's done, he comes in and he notices that there's a party going on, and he says, it's not my birthday, and there's no wedding happening, so what's the deal? It's not festival time. Why is there a party going on at my house? And so he grabs a servant and he asks him, what's going on? And the servant tells him, well, your brother's back safe and sound, so we're partying. Like, duh. It's obvious. We should be partying here. Your father's thrown a party for it. And I think what's running through his mind now is, you know, have you ever seen people driving maybe a really nice car and the bumper sticker, it's this old man, and the bumper sticker says, I bought this with my kid's inheritance? Like, who's throwing the party here with whose inheritance? It's all the older brothers. They're kind of partners, but in that sense, it's all the older brothers. And there's an explosion, right? The text says he got real angry. This isn't worth celebrating. He brought shame to our family. He's disgraced us. I can't believe this. He's insulted our father. He should have died in that country. That would have been what he deserved, right? I'm not going to this party. I'm not going to condone what my father's doing, welcoming him back. He doesn't deserve it. He abandoned us. I wish he were dead. Look at everything I've done. That comes out in the text. Look at everything I've done. I'm the one that deserves this party. This is the stuff he's telling himself. But the father, I love this. The father is in the party and he hasn't forgotten that he has two sons and one of them isn't there. And so what does he do? He goes looking for him. Again, just like last week. In other words, if we approach Easter as one of these two sons, it doesn't matter which one of them you are, the father's looking for you. And he'll leave the party to go find you. He is not indifferent to you. God is not indifferent to you. He actually likes you. And he's got lost boys. And he wants them back. And he goes outside, and if you look at your text, most translations, I think rightly, translate this saying that he pleads with his older son. He pleads. It could be just he invites him in. That is a legitimate way of translating it. It's more often used, this Greek word is more often used with a sense of urgency or exhortation. There's a little bit more feeling behind it than just, hey, I think you should come inside. And the way that they use this Greek word, the particular Greek tense of this word, has this idea of either a repeated invitation, like he's continually asking him, continually extending it, come on inside, like, we need you inside. Or it can give this sense of an ongoing sort of conversation. But it wasn't simply a, oh, there you are, come on in. And then father goes back in. There's this sense in the text of there is an ongoing pleading, or there is an ongoing urgency, or there is an ongoing conversation that the father is having with the son, trying to get him to come in. And then there's a second explosion. And we actually see what it is that the son says. He explodes on his father. I have been slaving for you all of this time. Slaving for you. I've never disobeyed one of your commandments. Never. He cast himself as the obedient slave. What does that make his father? Not a father, but a slave master. This is not a father-son relationship, according to the older son. It's a taskmaster-slave relationship. The older son is distancing himself from the father in the language that he uses. Notice that. I'm your slave. And then he distances himself in a second way. He says, this son of yours did this. Not my brother, this son of yours. In other words, if he's your son, I'm not. Do you see the way he has distanced himself from the father in two different ways, just with the language that he uses? He's pulling back. He already won't come into the house, and the father has to go out. And now he's pulling back even further when he's engaging with the father. Have you ever distanced yourself from God when things aren't going your way? Me too. And here we notice that something else is going on as well. I don't know if you've seen the show The Good Place. I like it, but that's not a recommendation because those get me in trouble. But I like this show, The Good Place. And on this show, there's a character, her name is Tahani. And Tahani raised billions of dollars to help kids in third world countries. And one day on the show, she has this light bulb moment where she realizes that her motivation was totally wrong. The only reason she was raising billions of dollars to help kids in Africa was so that she could show up her older sister and get her parents' attention. It's the exact same thing happening here. We see that the older son's motivation is completely wrong. He does the right things for the wrong reasons. He wanted reward. You never even gave me. I deserve the party. You never even gave me anything. And of course, that's completely untrue, right? Because literally, everything is now his. It says right at the beginning of the story, the father divided the inheritance between them. You never gave me anything except everything I currently got. But you didn't. You're stingy. He wants reward. It's kind of sad. He also rejects the father's compassion for his brother. He doesn't deserve this. He doesn't deserve this party. He squandered. He wasted. You know, he interprets, you know, where the story doesn't say, but he's, according to the older brother, he was out just playing it up with prostitutes the whole time. Jesus didn't say that when he told the story. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe that's actually a reflection of what's going on in the older brother, because that's what he would do. Who knows? But he's got this superiority complex, this, I'm better than you. I wouldn't have done this, or I didn't do this, but you did. And he doesn't like that the father is willing to show compassion and forgiveness for the younger son when he comes home. He didn't deserve it. He doesn't deserve it. Now look at the text. Notice how the father once again responds. The father starts by saying, my son. When he said, this son of yours, you know, you taskmaster, you slave master, this son of yours, he pulls himself away from the father. The father will take another step towards him. And the first thing he says to him is, my son, you're still my son. The father is still moving closer. It's just like last week. Last week when that younger son, as soon as the father can see just the slightest little bit of the younger son on the horizon, while he was still a long way off, the father moves in his direction. Well, the father's going to continue moving in the direction of the older son now too. Even when he distances himself, he's going to say, no, 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 no. My son, don't call me taskmaster. Don't call him the son of yours. He says, my son. And he reminds him that it's your brother. We're still a family unit. I haven't rejected you. He says, my son, you are always with me. You're always with me. Because to the father, this was never about duties. It was never about running a farm. You're always with me. It was about the relationship that they had and that he wants to continue having with him. We had to celebrate because your brother is back from the dead. The relationship has been restored. It's not that now we have more hands on deck for the work that needs to be done here. It's all about the relationship with the father. And that relationship is worth celebrating. So here are some of my big takeaways. I'm not going to repeat last week, so you can go back and listen to that. But the heart of the Father in this passage is just incredible. It gives us a picture of God that I think is amazing. It's probably one of the reasons Sarah loves this one so much, why many of us love this parable so much, because it shows us this incredible, tender heart that the Father has. He wants both of his kids close, including the one with the superiority complex. All of us in this room who think we are pretty good, and if we think that God, you know, steps out of line, we're ready to remind him that he should actually be acting in different ways. And God still wants to have that kind of person around. Like, I find those people irritating. Not God. Or at least he would still rather have you around. You can laugh at that. That's okay. That's good. I think God probably does actually laugh at the humor, like just enjoy the humor of that and still go, yeah, these are my kids. And they're full of themselves and I still love them. That's pretty cool. He loves even the self-righteous that just drive me nuts. He loves the people who tell him he's wrong, and he's still willing to engage with them. I like that. And he wants his kids to know his heart. He wants both of his kids to know his heart. He shows that to the younger brother, the younger son, by just running towards him and enveloping him and smothering him with affection and partying. That was last week. But he shows everyone how much the younger son means to him by partying publicly. But then he knows that the older son also needs to learn his heart as well. That older son who left by the back door. His heart is even for those who leave by the back door. So I like that God doesn't disown either of his kids in this parable. He doesn't reject the people who reject him. When we walk away in those subtle ways, and when we become passive aggressive with God, he doesn't reject people who reject him while we were sinners. While we were God's enemies, Christ died for us. We approach Easter knowing that. While we were yet sinners, while we thought we were better than God, Christ died for us. I like that. Someone dimmed the lights and I couldn't read the clock. Okay. I've got a couple of minutes. If someone has some questions, you want to engage, share a comment, how the parable strikes you. Is there a thought that comes to mind that you'd like to share or ask a question, something like that? Be happy to interact for a couple of minutes. Nate. It appears that the older brother never got an invitation to the party. It doesn't appear that anyone got an invitation to the party in the sense the party's for everyone because it's a public thing. They're in a village. The village is small. They're all interrelated families. That's the nature of small towns back in that time. And the older brother is simply coming in and hearing about it for the first time because he was out in the fields. But in the sense, when they kill the fatted calf, that's automatically an invitation to everyone because it's not enough for a single family. A fatted calf was enough to feed a village. So everyone's invited to the party. Oh, interesting. Thanks for reminding us that we can look into that as well. Thank you. Other observations, questions? Yep, Kent is observing that this father has a heart for all of his kids. And you're absolutely right. I think in one sense what we see in this parable is, I think the gift of this parable is that we have the extreme ends. You know, prodigal, who just goes as far as he can off the rails. And then an older son who just keeps walking the other direction because he knows better than God. And the rest of us can resonate with both of those, and we find ourselves somewhere in the middle. And the Father has a heart for all of us. Yeah. And you're right. Like, for God so loved the world, yet he started with his kids, but it was for God so loved the world, he gave his son. So,
truly good news.
Yeah, it's great news. This is the second time that someone from the Bromley clan has anticipated where I was going to go after Q&A. So, well done. And I will leave you hanging momentarily. Thank you. And I love that because, A, it means this was somewhat coherent. And B, you're tracking with it. You're tracking with where the story goes and where it's ending. So, well done. Anyone else want to comment or question on anything? Lionel. Yep, so I love this. Lionel is pointing out that I have fallen short. I only had 2 weeks, and actually when I set the scene and said, these are all of the people that Jesus is addressing, Pharisees and tax collectors, and he tells this story in response to the grumblings and so on. This is the third story that Jesus tells, and the first two are First of a lost sheep where the shepherd leaves 99 behind and goes looking for the lost one and rejoices when that lost one is found. The second story is when there is a woman who has lost a silver coin that's quite valuable. She's lost it in her house, and so she lights the lamps and sweeps the house and finds it, and she celebrates that it's that she has got it back. And so Lionel's saying that there is both repentance that gets celebrated in this, but also simply, I mean, the coin doesn't repent, but it's still that sense of the lost are found, and that is worth celebrating. And there's celebration in all three of them. And Lionel also pointed out that these are sort of increasingly valuable things that are lost and then found. First a sheep, then this silver coin, and then last the younger son and the older son. So, well done. Great observation. Thank you for reminding us that we always need to read in context. Well done. Anything else? Cool. Well done. Thank you for your questions and comments. I always really enjoy engaging. I love that. So thank you. Always thoughtful. As Susan said, in the end, we're sort of left wondering, what happens to the older brother? It's very much like the story of Jonah, where Jonah goes out and pouts outside of the city, and God comes to engage him, and God, they have this back and forth, and then God asks him a question, shouldn't I also care about Nineveh, this great city? And the book actually ends with a question mark, or it does in English. But it ends with a question, and we're left wondering, what's going to happen with Jonah? Is Jonah ever going to actually click in and get it and get back on God's program? Is Jonah actually going to receive the critique and say, I need to learn about God's heart for these lost people? And we got another Jonah here. We got an older brother who knows better than God. Knows better than his father. And the father comes out to engage him again, and he doesn't end with a question, but there is a question mark for us at the end of this parable in the sense of, did the older brother come back in? Did the older brother ever actually say to himself, oh, I need to learn from the father's heart for the lost? And maybe I need to learn that I'm lost and the Father's looking for me. I like that because it leaves us with the invitation that as much as we are the older brothers here, and we are, as the religious, the evangelicals, the people who wear button-up shirts to church, because that's what you should do. It leaves us wondering, where am I in this parable? And am I actually going to engage with this father's heart? Am I going to come back? Am I going to join the party? So there's very much that invitation there. I want to leave you with one final thought, and I haven't read this anywhere. This is Ben's, so you can take it or leave it. It's just sort of an idea that I've been mulling over as well. But in the same way that Jonah ends with God talking to Jonah, I love that this parable ends, and where's the Father? Where's God when this parable ends? He's still engaging with his kid. He's still engaging with the kid who, as far as we can tell in the parable, hasn't yet got on the Father's program. He's still pulling back. That's the last image we are left with. The last image that we see in this parable, which is why I didn't put Rembrandt up there today, as wonderful as Rembrandt's painting is. The image that we are left with in this parable is of a son pulling away and a father pulling closer. And I like that. Lord, the vision of you that Jesus gives us is just wonderful. This story is full of compassion, patience, long-suffering, faithful commitment to kids that you love. endurance for the difficult and the painful road of showing people your heart when they just don't get it. It shows us your engagement with people who want their own way and who think they're right. And we see you absorb insults and return them with gentleness. We see you endure self-righteousness in a way that's disarming and unexpected. We see your care and your winsomeness. We see you as a person who's safe to return to, whether we've left by the front door with our middle finger in the air or the back door with our superiority complex. We leave you all the time, yet you're safe to return to. So thank you that the front door is open and you run out to meet those rebellious kids who come home. And thank you that the back door is open and that you'll go and show your heart to the people who think they're pretty pleased with themselves and pretty good about keeping the rules themselves. Maybe even better than you. Lord, we confess that many times we trust more in our ability to keep your commandments than in the relationship that we have with you as your children. We confess that we're more interested in doing things for you than in being with you. So forgive us.